You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
This is Erica Nelson reporting for the Body Pro. You're about to sit in on one of the daily press conferences at CROI 2008, an intimate gathering where researchers discuss the findings of some of the most noteworthy studies at the conference. In this podcast, Dr. Ronald Stahl of the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health examines the reasons behind the rebounding HIV epidemic among men who have sex with men in the United States.
Good afternoon. The conference asked me to do a literature review about what's driving the AIDS epidemic among gay men, MSM, in the United States. And so my talk will address three primary questions. The first is, can HIV prevention work? The second is it working out in the community level? And the third level is, what can we do to make things better? The first question is easily answered. Can it work? The answer is yes. There have been two important meta-analyses that have already been published to show that in randomized controlled trials, model HIV prevention programs reduce risk among gay men in very big ways, and that these studies have already been published and give large effect sizes. For example, they include a 60% increase in using condoms for unprotected anal sex and so on. The next question is, are these programs actually working out in the real world? To answer this question, we turn to measures of incidence, HIV incidence, among Americans and men throughout the industrialized world. We conducted an analysis, a systematic review of incidence estimates for MSM in Western Europe, the United States, and Australia. The field tends to use proxy measures for incidence. That's because incidence estimates are very difficult and expensive to generate, and that may be especially the case among gay men. So you tend to see things in the literature about rising rates of unsafe sex, sexually transmitted infections, and so on. The other problem with incidence estimates is that if you use any one estimate for a given city, it can't be generalized to a whole country, nor can it even be generalized to that city because of sampling issues and on and on and on. So that by using all of the incidence literature across the industrialized countries, we hope to miss or avoid many of the problems that emerge with proxy measures for incidence rates or a standalone measure of incidence. Our review, using very stringent review criteria, identified 20 different studies from 1995 to 2005, the post-Proteus era in Western Europe, North America, and Australia, that yielded in turn 65 annualized incidence rates across this period. And on the international side, the rates of incidence in Australia, HIV incidence in Australia, are significantly lower at 1.1% than we're seeing in North America or Europe, where those rates are about the same. The other interesting finding is that there were no increases or decreases in incidence rates among MSM in the industrialized countries from 1995 to 2000. Rates are not going up or down. The weighted mean incidence rate across all these countries is 2.5% a year. Turning to the United States model, we looked at just the estimates for the United States in community-based samples, which were the lowest rate of HIV incidence compared to HIV alternative test sites or STD samples. We've calculated a mean incidence rate of about 2.4% a year. The next thing we did was we wanted to find out, what does 2.4% mean? What does 2.4% in particular mean over long periods of time? So we did a thought experiment using a closed cohort of young gay men at the age of 18, none of whom were infected at 18, but calculated an incidence rate of infection of 2.4% a year as these men moved in age from age 20 to age 40. The model that we constructed yielded an estimate that at about age 25, about 15% of the men would be HIV positive, by age 35, about a third, and by age 40, about 41%. The reason that we used the age of 40 as our cut point is that AIDS was discovered a quarter of a century ago. These men would have had to have been, by definition, younger than 15 years of age. In addition, because we know that HIV incidence rates were stable from 1995 to the present, the vast majority of their sexual lives would have been in the context of this background incidence rate of about 2.4-2.5%. We were kind of horrified that our model yielded prevalence estimates that high, and accordingly, we went back and looked at the largest samples published by the CDC of prevalence rates among American men in the United States. The CDC just published in 2005 a very large prevalence study of five American cities of HIV prevalence rates by age. What we find is that the model actually fits exactly what's going on in terms of HIV prevalence among gay men, at least in America's largest urban centers. So that this model that we are extrapolating based on the incidence rates that culminates in an HIV prevalence rate of 40% at age 40 is not something that's a prediction of something that may happen one day. We are describing epidemiological phenomena that are occurring all around us and will continue to occur among young American men if we do not find ways to lower HIV incidence rates further. The last part of the talk focuses on how we can do a better job of HIV prevention. And what I focus on are questions that gay men are asking about how to maintain sexual safety that are not being addressed by the proven programs that have yielded randomized control trial big effect sizes. Among these are precise definitions about what is sexual safety anymore, about maintenance of sexual safety over the long haul, about issues of community viral load. A very important analysis by Greg Millett at the Centers for Disease Control showed, for example, among African American men, that they are actually less risky than European American gay men and are less likely to use drugs. So if they're less risky and less likely to use drugs, where's all that virus coming from? Millett's answer in a really wonderful analysis he did showed that the rate of unknown HIV seropositivity and lack of access to antiretroviral care among African American men who know that they are positive is so high that you have a much higher prevalence rate of men who are viremic in the population, which we call community viral load, so that the context of men whose sexual access is limited by race, that those sexual networks have such a high community viral load that even modest levels of sexual risk-taking can result in very high transmission rates, even though the men are doing the best they can to be sexually safe. So it's the context that matters with these guys, not their individual risk-taking behavior. We also raise questions about the large investment that the United States has made in prevention science, but the challenge of getting this into the field so that community-based organizations can actually put these things into the field. And the amount of funding that's going in to support HIV prevention in the United States, it's actually a rather small sliver of the entire budget. Holtgrave and colleagues at Johns Hopkins has shown that the amount that we're investing in HIV prevention only allows us to kind of run in place in terms of winning the fight in AIDS prevention in the United States. So to summarize, what I've been able to show in the qualitative analysis is that there are multiple levels of prevention activity that are promoting risk among gay men, but that the interventions that we're using only operate at the level of the individual. They're not designed also to operate in terms of context like community viral load, in terms of funding for getting prevention projects into the field, in terms of policy, in terms of treatment for comorbid conditions, and on and on and on. And because we're only operating at one level as opposed to the multiple levels that are driving risk, it's analogous to using AZT monotherapy to treat HIV infection. You can get effect sizes for short periods of time, but you cannot expect big effects for long periods of time. And so I make an argument and provide a design for what I'm calling an HIV prevention cocktail. What would a prevention cocktail look like, and how would we get this into the field? Those are the main points, basically at the HIV incidence rates that we're already seeing in the published literature, we can expect an ongoing HIV epidemic among gay men that will yield high prevalence rates over time, and that the implications of this are so profound, we've got to find a smarter way to do HIV prevention in our country. Operating only at the level of the individual may not be the smartest way to go. Thank you.
Ron Bobrow in Medscape, what are the main points of your cocktail, your prevention cocktail?
I would help define definitions of what sexual risk is anymore. What are the risks of negotiated safety? What are the risks of positional strategies? And so on and so on. Gay men, like all men, are finding it difficult to use condoms every single time they have sex for decades on end. This is true of men in general. The gay community has set up a whole series of strategies to allow men to dispense with condoms in particular kinds of relationships, but we don't have strong epidemiological data to show the long-term risks of these things. The next would be, what would be the effect, and keep continuing the individual level interventions, but to also mount interventions that would be at the level of context. For example, what would happen if we really did our best to do strategies to diminish community viral load, particularly among African American MSM communities, so that men who are positive are found, they're offered treatment for HIV infection, they're brought into the medical system, they're given help around maintaining sexual safety over long periods of time, so that the community viral loads, and particularly vulnerable MSM communities, is lowered, so that just a tiny little slip within the sexual networks of these does not result in HIV transmission. Another would be finding support and better ways to get proven HIV interventions into the field, so that the scientific investment that the United States has made in terms of generating proven interventions can actually be used by community-based organizations. Another would be taking a good hard look at the investment that we're making in prevention overall and making a decision on the policy side of whether this investment will make the effect sizes that we need. The other would be to test what happens to see if we're doing multiple interventions at multiple levels to see whether or not the effect sizes we get by operating at multiple levels with the prevention cocktail does better than just operating at the level of the individual. Those are among the suggestions. There are others as well, Bob.
Other questions?
John Day from Positive Being in Australia. Did you see any relationship between post-exposure prophylaxis and reduction in transmission?
We didn't look at that. No, I did not look.
Hi, Brian Risley from Los Angeles. Following up on that, are there any biomedical strategies that you have talked about with colleagues or in research that you would endorse?
I would think that the biomedical strategy that I think would make a lot of sense would be to try and do focused interventions that look at reducing community viral loads. HIV risk isn't just about our own individual behavior. It's about the level of HIV prevalence out in the communities in which we find our sexual partners and the proportion of partners in those sexual networks that are viremic and efficient transmitters. And so looking at conjoined biomedical and social interventions that are effectively and efficiently find men and find HIV-positive people who are viremic and need to be brought into HIV treatment and are probably the best folk in which we can do to help them maintain sexual safety over the long haul would be, I think, an efficient use of our money. It's not just biology and it's not just behavior. It's interventions that would conjoin the two. By the way, on the Australian question, one of the interesting things is the incidence rates of infection in Australia are 1.1%. So that if you do the same model that I did for the United States, what you yield is by age 30, about 15% of the men would be positive, and by age 40, about 20%. So under conditions that have already been obtained in Australia among MSM communities, they would yield expected prevalence rates half of what we're seeing in the United States and one-third of what we're seeing among African-American MSM. You know, we can clearly do a better job, and I think we need to learn from our Australian colleagues and invent some strategies on our own that can help replicate these successes.
Jim Brown from Physicians Research Network in New York. Since there was recently published information about Western countries and how they score in preventable death, and the U.S. came in last, and part of the rationale for that is our healthcare delivery system. And I'm wondering, and HIV was not one of the parameters in that study, but certainly HIV is a preventable. If you can prevent HIV, you can prevent the death from HIV. And I'm just wondering, in looking at other countries that do a better job in preventable death, what they have done in this same sort of area that you're talking about and how we can learn from other countries. And does it not all boil down to the way that urgent care and acute care and healthcare delivery in general is accessible in our country? And is there any way it can be fixed short of total restructuring of healthcare delivery?
Oh, dear. I'm not running for president.
You could.
I think that's the question before us, is how do we make it work? Despite our very low ranking in terms of outcomes, we're spending among the highest costs of providing health care. And so clearly something is wrong. And finding something to make the American health care system actually provide care to American people, help Americans stay healthy, and do so at a less cost is, I think, the $100 million question. If it were only $100 million, that would be wonderful. And many people have worked on this. I don't have fast answers.
Maybe I could ask the last question. Do you feel that the gay community, and it's hard to define, obviously, is as engaged in giving the same priority to prevention as it did earlier on?
I think gay men are doing as good as any group of human beings could ever do in view of the onslaught that's happened over the past quarter of a century due to this epidemic. men are having a hard time staying consistently safe every single time we have sex. But that's true of all men. And what we need to do is look at what's happening around contextual issues and areas that we can help promote health among gay men that would increase the efficacy of our prevention efforts and increase our ability to do a better job with HIV prevention. I don't think it's helpful to lay blame at a community that is you know, that's a blaming the victim kind of analysis that some people do, and I don't want to engage in that. I think there's much smarter ways to promote health in these communities than blaming victims.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.